Okay, so last time we were talking about networking and remote procedure calls. I gave a very quick introduction to what networks were. I glossed over some material because I wanted to get to RMIs quickly, given that that is the main subject matter of Lab 3. So I'm going to go back and revisit last week's lecture and go over some of the material that I had skipped over in the interest of time, and we'll do that now. Okay, so keep in mind we talked about what is a network. I defined what is a distributed system first, and then we said what is a network. We talked about local area networks, wide area networks. We introduced a network protocol stack, TCP/IP, and so on. Okay. What I had not talked about last time were network topologies, typical topologies that are in use when you design a network of some sort, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Okay, and then I'm going to revisit some of the material on RPCs and RMIs, and then we will switch to the actual subject matter for today's class, which is going to be network and distributed file system. Okay, so continuing from where we were last time, I talked about LAN and WAN, local area networks and wide area networks. And typically, depending on how nodes in a network are connected, you get different topologies. Okay, and we'll talk about several of these. So the simplest one is what is called fully connected topology. Here, there is a physical wire or a physical connection from every node in the network to every other node. Okay, so this is basically the structure you get is a clique. Okay, it's a fully connected graph. And if you have a network structure of this form, then as you can imagine, any node can directly send a message to any other node in a single hop. Okay, there is no need for any intermediary because nodes are fully connected. Okay. There are order of n square edges for n nodes, which makes it hard to build as you have more and more nodes in the network. Okay. But it's very efficient from a communication standpoint. Failure of any node doesn't actually impact any other nodes because they can still communicate with the rest. Okay. Now clearly you can do this for some simple forms of LAN topologies, but for wide area that's a no-op. Okay. You cannot just have a physical wire going from every machine in the internet to every other machine. Okay. That just doesn't work. Okay. So most real topologies tend to be partially connected, not fully connected. Okay. So in partially connected topologies, you have physical links going from some nodes to some other node. Okay, so there is a path from any node to any other node, which allows you to actually send message from any machine to send a message to some other machine, but not directly. You have to go through some other node. Okay, so that's what is referred to as a partially connected network topology. Much less expensive because you don't have as many links in the graph. Okay, you can, depending on how sparse the graph is, you can have order of n links, okay, if you make it a chain or some sort of a partially connected network. Okay, but less resilient to failures as well. You may have what are called network partitions. So some nodes can get disconnected from the rest of the network. Okay, so if you, it's one of the, let's say that edge fails, okay, you have two graphs now. Okay, nodes in one subgraph cannot send a message to another subgraph, nodes in the other subgraph, because the network has got partition. Okay. This often happens when, let's say, you have an ISP and your main internet link goes down. Okay, your LAN network gets disconnected from the rest of the one. So you have basically what is called a network partition. Okay. So failures can partition the network in point-to-point topologies. It's not as robust to handling failures. And sending messages requires you to go through multiple hops. Okay, so in this case, if this node wants to send a message to that node, you will have to go through some intermediate nodes, okay, through some routers. Okay, you can communicate, but you will have to basically go through, messages will have to traverse multiple hops. Okay. As is mentioned here, typically, if you have a WAN, you will have a partially connected network, okay, never a fully connected network, because it's too expensive. So the next topology we'll talk about is a tree structure. Yeah, as the name suggests here, there is a root and then there are descendants in the tree structure. Okay, there aren't links going from one subtree to another. So it's a tree, not arbitrary graph. Okay, so communication here basically says if node A wants to communicate with node B, a message has to go up the tree to the first common ancestor and then it has to traverse down the tree. Okay, that's how communication will actually take place. Okay. Corporate networks typically like hierarchies. Corporations like hierarchies. Okay. So even in networks, they have hierarchies. Their domain names have hierarchies. So network structures also have hierarchies. In many cases, you may have a headquarters sitting at the top of the tree, and then you may have leaves depending on where your geographical branch offices are. You may have a structure of that. Not necessary, but in many cases, you may have either a logical hierarchy of a tree or a physical tree. Okay. And because a tree is also a partially connected graph, it is also not very robust to failures. Any link failure in this tree is going to essentially partition your network. Okay? And depending on where that link is, you may have different nodes in different subgraphs. Okay. Last topology for point-to-point is what is referred to as a star topology. Okay? So in a star topology, there is a node in the middle. Okay. And all other nodes are connected to that node. Okay. So any node can send a message to any other node in this topology in two hops. Okay. At most two hops where you send the message to the middle node and then it forwards it to the node that you are sending it. Okay. This form of this topology is very common when you have things like a Wi-Fi network. Okay. If you have a home wireless router, it is essentially your router is the node in the middle. All your clients are one hop away from the router. Okay, so if you want to talk, if you are on that LAN and you want to basically talk to a printer, let's say, you will send a message. All your messages will flow through the router from your machine to the printer. Okay, two hops. Okay, there are many other networks that also use star, but Wi-Fi networks are especially common. Okay, single access point Wi-Fi network, not corporate Wi-Fi networks which may have many, many access points. Now, again, this is partially connected. So, if the node in the middle fails, if your router goes down, your network is down. Okay? The same is true here. The node in the middle, the central node, is the most important node in this network. It is the node that enables all of the communication. Okay? So, if it is going to fail, then your network as a whole will be down. Okay? Not very robust to failures. Okay, there's one more I forgot. So those are point-to-point topologies, and now we'll look at some ring topologies. Okay, you don't see very many ring networks anymore, okay, not physical rings at least. You do see logical rings that are often used in peer-to-peer networks. Many P2P networks are organized in form of logical rings, not physical rings. But once upon a time, ring topologies were actually not only very popular, but also very common. Ring topologies were competing with Ethernet networks. Okay, Ethernet and rings were the two forms of LAN. If you actually went to buy a PC, you had to specify what kind of card you wanted, an Ethernet card or a token bus card, and a token bus was essentially a ring network. Okay, so you had these two competing forms of LAN. They didn't interoperate clearly. And then you know which one won out, because you don't hear of these token rings anymore. Okay, so Ethernet just took over, token rings faded away. But so you don't actually construct LANs, physical local area networks in this fashion anymore. Nevertheless, interesting to study. So here, as the name suggests, all the machines in the network are organized in the form of a ring. Okay? And you basically, any node can communicate with any other node by just sending a message to its neighbor, which forwarded to its neighbor and so on, and the message traverses the ring until it reaches the destination node. Okay. So, given n nodes, you may have a message may require at most n minus 1 hops. If you have a unidirectional ring, unidirectional ring says messages can either flow clockwise or anti-clockwise. Okay. So, you have to pick one and that's how the messages will traverse. So, in this case, you may have, on an average, you will have n over 2 hops. But in the worst case, you will have n minus 1 hops for n nodes. Okay? If you had a bidirectional ring, which means messages can flow in either direction, you can pick the shorter of the two paths and send it along. Okay? So you can decide, depending on which node you want to send, is sending it clockwise going to get it there faster or anti-clockwise, and you pick one of the two. Okay? In this case, the message has to go at most n over 2 hops. Okay? Because you don't have to, you can pick the shorter of the two. Okay, both of these will have problems if any node in this network actually dies. Okay, so basically you will have a network, your ring will get partitioned. Okay? Now keep in mind that in token bus networks, your machines that were sitting on the networks are also responsible for forwarding. The machine is part of the LAN. Okay? So all other messages that are flowing through this LAN actually go through your machine. Okay? So your machine is part of the forwarding part of the network. There is a forwarding function in the network. So if your PC dies, your token ring actually will get disconnected. Okay? So you need to address that in some way. Yeah, so here is a, and as I was mentioning, peer-to-peer networks of many forms, they actually use logical ring topology. They are actually built to be robust to nodes coming and going. Because in a P2P network, you can actually disconnect your P2P client, and then your client can't do any forwarding anymore if it is responsible for forwarding. So you need robustness in ring networks to ensure that the network, the LAN continues to function. Okay, one way to ensure this is to have what are called doubly connected ring. In a doubly connected ring, each node can not only talk to its two immediate neighbors, it can also talk to your neighbor's neighbors. Okay? So now if this node goes down, okay, you can just hop over this node by using that link. Okay, your network ring is not going to get partitioned. Okay, so in a doubly connected network, you can handle some failures. Okay, if two adjacent neighbors both go down at the same time, your network will get partitioned. But if on an average, if random nodes fail, then you can still tolerate those links failures by just hopping over those links and just sending a message directly to your neighbor's neighbor because your neighbor is down. Okay, so that's one advantage of a doubly connected ring, which is it is more tolerant for failure. Okay? Another advantage is that you can send the message much faster. Okay, because the inner ring basically allows you to skip nodes. Okay, so if the actual node you want to talk to is 10 hops away, you can just skip nodes by just sending it on the fast path. You can just go that way, and then you can go to the right node. Okay, so here messages take at most n by 4 hops, and assuming it's bidirectional. Okay, because you can skip nodes, you don't have to go through every node. Yeah, you can just skip in order to get there faster. Okay, any questions on doubly connected ring? Okay, so the last topology we'll talk about are bus-based network. These are the ones that we normally see. Ethernet is an example of a bus-based network. Okay, in a bus-based network, as the name suggests, there's a shared communication medium, the bus, in this case it's the network itself. And all nodes actually sit on this bus. So here is an example of a linear bus. Okay? They share the connection. Okay? So what this also says is that at most one node can actually send a message to any other node at any time. Okay? If two nodes try to send a packet at the same time, that packet is going to collide. Okay? They will basically, the message will get garbled. Okay? So you need a way by which only one node can communicate. Okay? And then once that node is done, some other node gets a turn. Okay, so in bus-based network, you need a form of arbitration. Just as in the system bus, you need the system bus, it has to arbitrate. If an I/O device wants to do DMA to memory, and the CPU also wants to access memory at the same time, you cannot have all of these things happen simultaneously. Okay, each one needs to go in turn. Same is true here. Okay, if two nodes want to send network packets at the same time, one node has to back off, okay, and some other node has to go first. Okay. So it's much cheaper to build these networks, yeah, because it's shared. But the networking becomes a little more complicated because simultaneous transmissions are not allowed. Well, no, they shouldn't say they're not allowed. Simultaneous transmissions cause problems. Okay? They cause collisions on the network and your messages get garbled. Okay, so, as I said, Ethernet LAN uses this structure. And I should also mention that this is true for early forms of Ethernet. Okay, now as you go to gigabit and 10 gigabit Ethernet, you have switched networks, which basically means that not every packet goes to every node anymore. Your switch can start doing smart things and not forward packets to all the nodes needlessly. Okay. But you can still get Ethernet switches that essentially do this. Whenever a node sends a packet, it goes to all the other nodes. It's broadcast, and the node that is the destination receives it. The other form of bus topology is what is called a ring bus. Okay, so here you basically have essentially a ring which is the shared medium and nodes are tapping onto the ring. The same is true as a linear bus, except that you can assume that there's a loop that goes from one end to another and you get a ring bus. Okay, so same, all of what I said here is going to apply to the ring bus as well. Okay, only one node can communicate, there can be collisions and so on. Okay, there needs to be some arbitration, etc. Any questions on this? Okay, so whatever I said here is true whether you actually have physical wire connecting nodes or whether you are doing this on wireless. Okay, in wireless, your medium is air, but that doesn't change anything that I said here. If you have a Wi-Fi network, okay, and you, basically you can have only one node send on one channel at a given time. If two nodes try to send packets on the channel, they will collide. Okay, channel is a frequency over which you communicate. Okay, different channels are independent, so you can have independent communication, but on any given channel, it looks exactly like Ethernet. Basically, it's shared, and you don't have physical wires, you just have an access point that you're talking to. Okay, so packets can collide over the air, so you need to arbitrate. Okay, only one node can talk to the access point at any given time. Okay, so that's what I had to say about networking material that I had skipped last time. I'm going to go back quickly and talk a little bit more about client-server and remote procedure calls. I did that quickly and we were running out of time. So I want to emphasize that again. Okay. So as I mentioned, client-server model is a very popular model for designing distributed application. Okay. So in this model, your application functionality is split into two parts, a server part and the client part. Okay. The server part of your application provides a service. The client part makes requests of the service. A very popular model for building variety of different applications. Print servers are an example of where you have clients printing to a print server, or a network server is an example of this. Distributed file servers are an example of this. Email is an example of this. Typically, email arrives at a server. You have a mail client, maybe on laptop, it may be a phone. You just access your mail on the mail server through that client. Okay. Very popular way of designing distributed application. As I mentioned, the other technique that is typically used in some cases is the peer-to-peer model. Okay, in a peer-to-peer model, there is no distinction between nodes. In a client-server model, there are nodes that are either clients or servers. Okay, servers are more distinguished nodes. They are the ones providing the service, and clients are simply accessing the service. Okay, in a P2P model, typically a node provides both functions. It can be a server or a client, which is why it's just called a peer. Okay, we won't talk about P2P anymore, just wanted to mention that. Okay, so server is a process that provides a service, client is a program that uses the service. Typically, clients and servers run on different machines. The standard assumption is there are many, many more clients than servers, typically. Okay, so it's a small number of servers, large number of clients. Many ways to write applications using the client-server model. The one that I had mentioned last time was using RPCs, okay, or remote procedure calls. So RPCs were made available commercially first by Sun Microsystems, okay, which designed Solaris, a form of Unix that's still in use today. Okay, so this was, I think, 25-30 years ago. Okay, it's a very popular way of writing applications. The advantage of using RPCs is that you use your same abstractions that you are used to. You take your application, you partition it into methods or functions, okay, and one method calls another method. Okay. In RPCs, it just so happens that some methods are remote. They sit on another. The code for those methods sits on another machine. Okay. And the RPC subsystem, in this case, takes care of all of the networking for you. So you don't have to, you as in the programmer, don't have to write code to actually make a request to a method sitting on another machine. It's all taken care of for you. Okay. So what happens is you typically write the interface to the method, and then you run this program through a special compiler, an RPC compiler. The RPC compiler generates what is called stub code. The stub code has all of the details of how do you actually construct a packet, how do you send that packet or a message to the server, how do you get back the response, how do you hand that response back to the user process that called it, and so on. So this is the code that you are actually going to link to your application when you compile your application. Okay, so you write some C code. Okay, this is typically done in C or C++. Same concepts apply to Java, but let me just tell you what happens in C. So you will write the high-level C code, which is going to either implement the server method or call this code that calls the server method. And then you run it through a compiler, typically an RPC compiler like RPCGen, and it will generate a file for you. Okay, that file will have all of this code. Then you take that code and your code and you link it together and you construct one binary. Okay? And then when you run the binary, when you make the RPC call, your call will internally go to the stub code and it will do all of these things for you. It will build a message. Okay? Well, first you have to, first you have to bind to the server. You have to first find out where the server is running, okay, and establish a connection to the server. Okay, typically or TCP or UDP, okay, depending on whichever protocol you have configured in the RPC compiler. Or specified to the RPC compiler. So you, then you, once you bind to the server, you build a message, you will then construct the message, you will send the message over the network, you will wait for a response. Okay? And then when the response comes back, you will unpack the reply and you will return the result. Okay, on the server side, you are going to basically, your automatic code generation will do all of these tasks for you. Okay? So you will sit in a loop waiting for requests to arrive over a network. Okay? The clients will send those requests. Whenever each request comes in, you will unpack whatever is in the message. You will figure out what method is being called. Okay, you may have more than one method on each server. Okay, and then you will figure out what procedure is being called. You will invoke that procedure with the right arguments, which are also sent with that message. And then you will take the results and send it back. Okay. In addition to all of this, this threading is also taken care of for you. Okay, typically, most RPC compilers will automatically generate code so that every request that comes in can spawn off its own thread. Okay, so it's called a thread per request model. Okay, a request comes in, new thread is started up, and then it's given that request. It goes off, it processes your request, sends back a reply, and then the thread is terminated. Okay, so every request can start a new thread. Okay, you can also have a static pool of thread depending on how sophisticated your RPC compiler is. So some of these concepts will apply also to Java and specifically to the lab. Okay, so we should keep that in mind. Although this is all done in C, the same kinds of concepts apply. Okay, very quickly, I'll recap what we had talked about as far as RMI is concerned. Okay, remote methods or remote method invocation is are RPCs in the Java world. Okay, they are built into the language. Okay, so it's sort of part of the language. RPCs are not part of C. There are libraries that are written on top of C. Okay. In case of Java, RMI is built into the support for RMI is built into the language. Okay. It's part of the Java spec. Okay. Typically, what you have to do is you need to provide objects or classes that will allow you to figure out where is the server, bind to that server. Okay. This is done through a bind method. You can, and the way you figure out where is the server is through a lookup method. Okay. So you ask some directory service saying, where is the server that provides this service? And you name the service, okay, or the method you want to call. And the server has to have registered with that directory service. And it will basically tell you that the server is running on this machine. This is the IP address. This is the port number. And then your client stub will actually use that information and bind to that server. You don't actually go and do any, write any code to set up connections, the RMI object will do it for you. Okay? This is basically the object that is going to do all of the hard work. It's called remote unicast object. That's a class in Java. Okay, so here is, this is the RMI registry. This is the server side name server. You have many tools. This is one that is called the RMI compiler, but there are many others. Okay, that's the one that will generate the stub for you. Okay. So typically, so that's the background. So this is how you write RMI server and a client in Java. Okay, so to write the server, you have to do three things. You have to first define an interface, and those are the methods or the signatures of the methods that the server provides. That's the service. Those are the remote methods that can be invoked. So that's the interface. Then there's an implementation of the interface. That's actually the code for every remote method. Okay. And the third is the main program. Okay. That's the program that's going to register the server with the name server, okay, or the directory service. Okay. So typically, to write the server side, you have to do those three things. Okay. So to the client part is much simpler. To do the client part, you have to first look up the server. Once you've figured out where the server is running, you just use the normal call syntax to actually call remote methods. Okay, and you need to be able to handle a special type of exception called remote exception. Okay, because if you make any mistake, the server is going to throw a remote exception. This exception will come to you over a network, okay, rather than a local Java exception. Okay, so if you do those three things, then you have a client that will talk to your server. Okay, so let me show you examples of the three things on the server. So this is the interface part of the server. Okay? This is where you define what methods, remote methods, the server is going to implement. Okay? This is what is used to actually generate the stub code. So here is a server that implements exactly one remote method. This is a Hello World server. So all that this does is it gives you a string called Hello World. Okay? So this, you basically have a func method that says say hello. Okay? That's the interface of your service. And as you can see, there is a you have to basically extend this class called Java RMI, java.rmi. Okay, so that was the interface. This is the implementation of the server. Okay, so this is where you implement that method that you declared was a remote method. So it basically is a trivial method. You just return a string. Okay, but this is where you do all the hard work. Okay, at your lab 3, that's where you will actually put the server side code. So that's all it's doing. You've implemented a class, and this class is going to extend as unicast remote object class. Okay, and then this is the implementation of a method in that class. Okay, so that's the second part of the server. The third part, as I said, is the main program itself. Okay, so all you have to do here is to essentially create a new instance of that object. Okay, that's the Hello World object. And then you basically register yourself with the server, saying, I am a service and this is the object that I am exporting. And then you are done as far as the server is concerned. Okay, you don't have to set up connection. None of that code has to be written. Okay, all that is taken care of for you. And the client side is also straightforward. Okay, all you have to do is first you have to look up the server. Say, where is this server running? Okay. And once you've done that, you just call the remote object. So you just say object.sayHello. Okay. That looks like you're calling a method on a local object. It just so happens that this object is actually sitting on another machine. So your code looks exactly the same as if you're calling local objects. Okay. So you can write it without too many new abstractions. And then you will basically, as I said, you have to handle something called remote exceptions. Okay, because if there's a network error, you will get an exception. Okay. This is a very simple client-server application, just to illustrate the broad principle of how you are going to do RPCs or RMIs. Okay. And this is a distributed application. The client is an independent process that's going to run on one machine. Server is an independent process that runs on another machine, and the two communicate over a network. It doesn't matter whether your network is a LAN or a WAN. The same code will work. Same code will work whether you run both the client and the server on the same machine, okay, but separate processes, or different machines. Okay, any questions on this before I move on to distributed file? I wanted to re-emphasize this just so that the basic concept is clear for those of you at least who don't have a networking background. Okay. Okay, so we just finished the RPCs and RMI topic, and we are going to switch gears and start the next topic here, which is network file systems and distributed file system. Okay, so we'll assume now you know we are going to keep building. Okay, so this is a 3-lecture sequence, but each lecture is actually building, or each component is building on the previous one. So we did networks. What are networks? How do they work? And we said, how do you write client-server applications on those networks using RPCs specifically? Okay. Now we are going to look at a particular applications that is typically used or written using RPCs, namely distributed file system. Okay, very complicated application, but provides a lot of interesting convenience from a user perspective. Okay. So most common example of a distributed system, or the earliest ones. Okay, now there are lots of them. Okay. So what does a distributed file system do? Essentially, it allows you to access files stored on another machine. Okay. So typically, if you have a local disk on your machine, you can access those files. Okay. Now what if you wanted to access files on another machine? Okay. If you have a distributed file system, it allows you to access remote files as if they were local files. You don't have to do anything different except form a connection to the server. And then the server will allow you to access those files as if they're local files. Okay? So given a set of disks attached to different nodes, you can share those disks between nodes as if they were all locally attached. Okay? So this is a form of resource sharing. Okay, you will see many examples of this. Okay? You probably have gone to the EdLab at some point or the other, or at least used it remotely. And what you see is, if you log on to an EdLab workstation, your files that you are actually accessing are not local to that machine. They are actually stored on a server somewhere else. Okay? And you are using a distributed file system. In that case, it's NFS, Network File System, to access those files. Okay? There are many other forms of distributed file system. In Windows, you have network shares. Okay? Mm-hmm. On Macs, you have Apple file partitions. Okay? And so on. I'll show you examples of that. Okay, so there are many issues you have to deal with when you talk about designing a distributed file system. Okay, and these are some issues we have also seen before when I talked about distributed systems design in general. Okay, first one is naming and transparency. How do you actually name files that are stored on another machine? Okay, we'll see examples in just a moment. Okay, what is the form of remote access? We'll see that there are two principal ways of designing a distributed file system. Okay. What is called a remote access model or a caching oriented model. Okay. And we'll see what are the differences of these two forms. Okay. You can use performance optimizations in the form of caching, but we'll see that that makes some other aspects more complicated. Okay. And we'll see what those are. We'll see that you can make the server stateful or stateless, and we'll also see that you can employ replication of your files to make performance better. Okay. So we'll go through each of this one by one. Okay, so let's talk about the first one. Okay, that is called naming and transparency. Okay, so here issues are, how are files named? Do file names reveal their locations? And do file names change if the location moves or the user moves? Okay, there are two key concepts here. One is called location transparency. The other one is called location independence. Okay, they sound similar, but they're actually slightly different things. Location transparency says that the file name does not reveal its location in terms of what server it is stored on. Okay. Location independence says that the file name doesn't even change if it moves location. If it moves from one server to another, the file name remains the same. That's a handle that is not going to change. It's not bound to the machine. It's bound to the object of the file. Okay, and let's look at some examples. Okay, so the last point here, which says most file systems actually do provide location transparency, but location independence, many of them don't. Okay, only few do. Okay, so let me give you an example here. Okay, so I am going to connect to a server here. Okay, I'm going to use the Apple File Protocol. It's a form of a network protocol. That's a server. Okay, so can you see? I don't know whether I can make it bigger. Okay, so I just have a name of a protocol and a file server. We'll see what happens in just a minute. Okay, so we connect. then ask me for a volume, that's not important. Okay, so now I have a network share mounted on this local machine. Okay, you can look at it graphically or you can look at it here. Okay, so let's look at what it looks like here. So that's basically the network share. So here is the name of the server, and that is basically the volume that I mounted on the server. That's the user, okay, and that's where it's mounted. So if I actually go in, so I can just now So these are all files that are not local, they are actually remote. Okay? But I'm accessing them as if they are local. Okay? Every request I make now actually has to be sent off to a server. The server is sending. So even if I do ls, which is the list files in this directory, okay, that becomes a remote procedure call, okay, because this is implemented using RPCs. The RPC call goes to the server. The server implements that request or executes that request, sends back the response. Okay, so distributed file systems are typically implemented using RPCs. Okay, so two things. Okay, first is accessing remote files is now just as convenient as accessing local files. Okay, you can do the same thing graphically. Here is that volume I just mounted, and then you can go into public HTML or whatever some directory. Okay, so these are all remote files. Okay, you can access them. You can do whatever you need to do. Okay. So now let's look at file names here. Okay, so here is. Okay. So typically the name is, so that's the mount point. It says slash volume some mount point, and you can access the file. That does not necessarily include the name of the server. That's basically tied here. When I did this df, you could see that the server name was here, that's nun.cs.umass.ed. Okay? But when you access a file, you can leave out the server name. Okay? That basically gives you a form of location transparency. Okay? Compare that to URLs. Okay? If you have a URL, which is another form of naming, this is naming for the web, you basically have to do things like this. So you can say something like registrar's calendar, okay, to go to the academic calendar. Okay. So this URL actually has the name of the server embedded in it. This is not location transparent because you have to specify the name of the server as part of the name of the object. In this case, the web page you are trying to retrieve. Okay. If you have a name of this form, this name does not have the server name embedded in it. Okay? The server name is known to the OS. Okay? The OS knows when you say volumes who what server actually has. questions here.
How is this not independent?
How is this not location independent? Location independent says that if I move this from one server to another, you can still access it with this name. That is not true. Right? Because, I mean, the name will change. Okay? Yes.
But isn't it though? Like when you...
This part of the name is... Let's say you have a local machine where you have slash your home, or let's call them users. And then you have bin local. So this is your local file system hierarchy. Okay, let's assume that there is a file server. Okay, that exports a part of its table. So you will see that this is the line that specifies that mapping. It says go, this machine has this volume, okay, this directory, take that and mount it here. Okay, so this is the local part of the subtree where that is going to be available. Okay, so you okay. So there are some other file systems that use a different naming strategy. In particular, there are some that use what is called a global namespace. What we mean by global namespace is independent of what machine you are accessing a file from, the file has the exact same namespace independent of how you, where you access it. Okay, there are two examples of this. There is something called the Andrew file system, which was developed at CMU, commercialized, all available now in Linux, also available as commercial file system. There's another one called a Sprite file system that made this naming convention popular. Okay. The simplest way to understand it establishes a connection with the Andrew file server and then basically gets the structure, and then you can access it in this fashion. Okay, so I already mentioned the naming is consistent, it's easy to keep consistent. Disadvantage is it's basically difficult to keep the file contents consistent during caching because many nodes can access these files. Problem when you have larger and larger system, ensuring scalability of your system gets harder and harder. Okay, so performance is a problem when you have a very large file system. So that's another issue to keep in mind. Okay, so now let's talk about remote file access and caching. Okay, so the way to understand this is there are two ways to access remote files. Okay, one is called the remote access model and the other one, as I said, is the caching model. I can draw a picture here to illustrate. Okay, so this, let's say that's the server. There's a file server. Okay, there's a file called foo.txt that is accessible to this client. There's a network here. So you open, let's say foo.txt in an editor. And you start editing this file. Okay. So how does the distributed file system or the network file system take care of this? Okay. One way is what is called a remote. All of the updated contents are sent over here and you basically update the contents of that file. Okay. This is referred to as the remote service or the remote access model. Okay, the other one is caching oriented, which basically I should say not. Thank you. Okay. So that's the good part of caching. It's faster, you can tolerate failures and so on. So there is a bad part as well, not a bad part, something that's more harder to deal with. What might that be? So let's say now there are two clients that are both accessing this file, foo.txt. So if you use the caching model, you'll have a copy of that file on this machine and a copy of that file on the other machine. And if both of these clients happen to update the file, you may trample on each other. You send these writes over, and then this machine also updates it, and then you send that write over, and you may overwrite the previous one. The access model, all writes are actually sent there. Yeah, so you make a write or you update it, you send it there. You make another write, you send it. And when you read it, you are actually reading whatever was written last. So you always have an up-to-date version. Okay? So there are two issues. One is to keep files consistent, and the other is files may become stale. If one is reading and the other is writing, have the changes that are made by this client. So you have stale cache copy stale in this case. In another case, you have consistency problem where you have what is called a write-write conflict. Okay, two machines updated the file at the same time. Okay, one has trampled over the changes made by the other. Okay, that's also a problem. So whenever you have caching, you might have multiple copies of the same object in multiple caches, and you have to deal with what is referred to as cache consistency. Major issue with any time you have caching is to ensure that cached copies are consistent. Okay, so that's essentially what's being said here. What happens when, how are modifications sent back? What if multiple clients cache the same file? So if you design a caching-oriented file system, you have to answer this question and have some satisfactory solution. Otherwise, the clients will see weird behavior. Okay, so you may say, I just wrote that file there. Why is it that I cannot access it here? Okay, this happens all the time. If you are actually editing your file on one machine and compiling your file on another machine, you have a different build machine and a development machine. You save it here, and then you run make here. Sometimes it takes a while for these changes to actually go to the server. So this server may have an old copy of the file. It may not even see those changes. Then you get weird compilation problems. You say, I just made that change. I run the code. I don't see my change reflected in the code. So these kinds of weird things can happen. Okay. So let me talk a little. Okay. So there are many ways to deal with cache consistency. Okay, I will next time, not today, we'll do a case study of NFS. We'll see what caching policies are in use in that case. Okay. The only way to deal with this really is if the server really keeps track of which clients are caching a file. Okay? And every time there's a write to a file, the client tells the server saying, I have made a change. And then the server can tell the other client saying, file has changed. Please throw it a copy of because it's out of date. Okay? Only if you do this, can you ensure that all data will be consistent. You will not have the problem. Okay? Now, what I just said is actually what is referred to as a stateful server. The server has to keep track of where are the copies cached, who has cached the copy. Every time there's a change and a request, a notification comes from a client, you have to broadcast an update saying, throw away your copy because it's out of date. Okay, all this is expensive to do. This is referred to as a cache consistency protocol, what I just mentioned. Okay. Many operating systems take the short. All the written blocks to the server. Okay. So it may take 30 seconds for a local write to even be visible to the server. So you open a file, and you hit change it and you hit save, it may take up to 30 seconds for your client to even send that version of the file to the server. Okay? So for up to 30 seconds, everything may be out of sync. Okay? So that's the policy. It's not necessarily a good one, but it's simple. Okay? You don't have to implement any complicated mechanism. Okay, the reason NFS implements this policy is NFS has a policy decision to keep the server stateless. The server doesn't track anything. It doesn't know who has cached the file. It's all the client job. If the server doesn't keep track of it, you cannot tell when the file has changed who should invalidate the file. Yes.
Is that a two-way synchronization? So if someone, a second party changes foo.txt while you are looking at foo.txt, will that be updated with NFS?
NFS doesn't do anything. Right, so NFS has here, if you update it, if you hit save and you update it, after 30 seconds, these changes are, okay, so it may take up to 30 seconds for this to go. Okay. Now, because the server is stateless, it doesn't even know that client 2 also has a copy of that file. It's up to client 2 to actually check with the server, saying, has the file changed? Okay, so every few seconds, it may go and say, I have a copy of these blocks concurrent or not. Okay. Server. If the server was stateful, the server could say, this file is actually cached by client 1 and client 2. I have a new version. Okay. So if you happen to be still accessing it, come back.